Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the bodybuilding.com podcast. Coffee's on, coffee's hot, weather's cold. I'm Nick Coleus, an editor for bodybuilding.com. Heather Eastman, also an editor, a physique judge and competitor. Our guest is a self-described physique scientist. He's Dr. Bill Campbell, exercise science professor at the University of South Florida, and the director of the Performance and Physique Enhancement Lab, which is an actual thing people may have not known, the Physique Enhancement Laboratory. They study dieting models, training frequency, the effects of pre-workouts on power performance, periodization models for powerlifters, all sorts of fun
stuff. All the fun stuff.
Like, I envision a big board where you guys are cooking up all sorts of fun ideas there.
That's pretty much how it works.
So we have I don't know if you've gotten the tour yet, we have like a protein dispenser in the gym, we've got the amino acid fountain in the cafeteria. Mm-hmm. What do you guys have that's cool?
We have post-workout protein for all of my staff and myself.
Just in a tub, or is it like...
No, just in a tub. And it's Dymatize. Dymatize is kind enough to...
You guys are tied in. Mm-hmm.
Yes, So they sponsor some of our studies, and they make sure that my staff... I have a large volunteer staff, undergraduate, graduate students, so we are never short on protein.
Yes.
And
cool machines, something that you see, think you go, oh my God, this thing's a game changer.
Yeah, I mean, it's the fun stuff, like a metabolic rate machine. Mm-hmm. So we use the heck out of that. And then my lab's really just a nice weight room. It's a weight room. And then we also use ultrasound for body composition. We have a body water machine. We just got a new machine to test fat breakdown. So it's
very cool.
Yeah, it's fun stuff.
Okay, cool. And we have a bunch of stuff we want to talk to you about while we can. Two of them in particular were protein intake for women and flexible dieting.
Yes.
You already wrote one great article for us last year called something along the lines of how much protein do women really need? If you go to bodybuilding.com and look for Bill Campbell, you can find it pretty easily. But yeah, it goes in depth, and that's something that you've been studying actually, is just the simple addition of protein. It's not like it's this massive change to somebody's diet. It's almost just like, yeah, what happens when you just take in more protein?
Yes.
So tell us what you've been studying.
So what we did was we took aspiring female physique athletes, and we did a simple study. We put them into two groups. We had a high protein group and a low protein group. Mm-hmm. And if you want numbers, we told the high protein group, eat about 2.5 grams of protein per kilogram of body mass. Mm-hmm. The low protein group, we said, eat about half that. So about 1.2 grams per kg.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Which
is still higher than the recommended daily amount.
Yeah, it's still, I mean, that's what a lot of people...
What does that translate into on the high end for how it actually plays out in somebody's diet?
Yes.
Is it just a couple of shakes a day more, or what is it?
Well, if you're a 125-pound female, it would be about 140 grams per day of protein. So, I mean, each scoop of whey protein is about 25 grams.
Okay, so if you ate 3 to 4 solid meals, couple of shakes...
You're easily there. And then the low protein group, for the same 125-pound female, it would be about 70 grams of protein per day, which is pretty low.
Right.
So what we did, we told them, do whatever you want with carbs and fat. I don't care. Just don't diet.
By taste.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We don't want you losing weight on this study. We want you to eat enough protein, or make sure you don't eat an X amount of protein if you're in the low group.
Mm-hmm.
So very simple study design. We had them come to my lab 4 days per week for weight training. So they did 2 days of upper body, 2 days of lower body for 8 weeks. So we supervised every set, every rep. They tracked their macros every day. So these weren't just diet records. They literally tracked every gram of carbs, protein, and fat for 8 weeks. And that was a big training on my staff, because some people don't know how to track macros.
Right. Even these physique competitors, some of them didn't know how to track.
Yes. Now, they were aspiring. So not all of them were competitors. Some were. Some had the desire to compete within that next year. So they weren't all competitors at that time.
Mm-hmm.
So what we did was brought them in before and after the 8 week study, and the results were maybe surprising, maybe not. The high protein group gained 4.5 pounds of muscle mass. The low protein group gained about 1.5 pounds.
Mm.
So significant difference in muscle mass loss.
Now,
muscle mass gain.
Oh, yes. That's a big difference.
Jose Antonio was talking to us about when he did a similar study, they actually had one vegetarian in their group who wasn't eating animal protein. Did you have any similar, because we get a lot of questions about that, you know, I don't eat meat, what can I do? So did you have anyone in your group?
We did not have any vegetarians, fortunately, because that always complicates things.
But those vegetarians.
Yeah, in theory, I suppose they could, I mean, we wouldn't have excluded them on that because, again, they could have, we didn't care where they got their protein from, so it could have been all from supplemental sources.
Okay.
Let me tell you the really intriguing part of this study. And I call it the protein aberration. So this high protein group, they ingested about 425 extra calories every day for 8 weeks because they were adding protein to their diet. So
just in terms of pure protein calories.
Yeah, there was no difference in carbs or fat between the two groups, but a significant difference in total calories and protein over the 8 weeks. So normally, if you look at a group and you say, hey, they're eating 400 more calories every day, you would say, well, they're probably going to gain a little more fat. They lost more fat than the low protein group, eating less calories. That's crazy talk.
So in addition to gaining 4 pounds of muscle, which is a lot for women.
Yes, 4.5 pounds. Yes.
Wow. Mm,
but they were lifting 4 times a week too. I feel like there's interplay there potentially.
Well, we've always heard women, you know, that we can gain maybe a pound of muscle a month. And so that's almost a little over 2 pounds of muscle
Yes.
in a 4 week period.
Yeah,
so their actual body weight stayed about the same, but body composition changed then?
Yes.
Or did their okay.
Weight gain went up a little bit in the high protein group. Mm-hmm. Now, let me critique my own study. What we did not do at the time was we did not track water changes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I have that technology now in my lab. So every study we do now, we make sure, hey, was this gain all muscle? Was some of it water? So it could be that some of that was more water and not pure muscle. I don't know. But clearly they gain more muscle because you don't gain 4.5 pounds of water.
Right.
Wow. I like this idea, though, of – It's almost like free calories, but it's almost it changes the whole idea. Like people say, oh, calories in, calories out. This really is an arrow in the side of
yes.
that.
Yes. Now, if I didn't see that in my own lab, in my own data, I wouldn't believe it. In fact, there was a study by Dr. Antonio. He did a study probably about a year prior, not quite as controlled. They didn't supervise the workouts, but they noticed the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
That study, I think it was more like 700 calories extra from protein, and they lost fat.
They
still lost fat.
Bit.
Yeah,
we mentioned that. So that's now
podcast.
Two studies in a resistance-trained population that are reporting the same thing. So now and I'm a doubter. As a scientist, I don't believe a lot of things.
Right.
There's something going on here with protein.
How much do you think it matters that these are experienced weight training athletes who are probably portion conscious already? They probably have a history of eating fairly well, or maybe not, but they also have a muscular base already.
Yeah,
how do you scale this or apply this to, you know, a group outside of aspiring physique competitors?
Yeah, so the fact that they were aspiring, not all of the subjects have been lifting for 4 and 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
I think we had a requirement of the previous 3 months. They also had to deadlift. I'm trying to remember. I think it was maybe deadlift 1.5 times their body weight. 1.25 times
by
their
the
body
end or
weight.
By the beginning?
No, just to get into the study.
Okay.
So we wanted to verify.
Mm-hmm.
You can say you're training, but show me some objective evidence that you've actually been lifting weights.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I don't want to give the impression that these are seasoned competitors, because I don't think we would see 4.5 pounds of muscle gain in competitors that have been training for 3, 4, 5 years, that have been competing for years. So this would be in the early part of a physique competitor's career, these types of gains.
Wow.
Really cool.
So how crucial do you think it was that they were lifting 4 times a week? Because four times a week for a lot of women, that's probably a lot. How do you think it would have been different if, A, they were just lifting twice a week, or maybe if they were cardio bunny adding all of this protein to their diet?
Yeah, so we limited cardio in the study. They could only do high intensity interval training, and it started at like 2 sets per week, and it got up to 8 sets per week.
Mm-hmm.
So 8 sets of 30 seconds, all out sprints
on bike.
Their choice. So bike, sprinting, treadmill.
It's no fun either way.
No matter what you're doing,
pick your poison, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's going to suck. Just do it.
But clearly, if they were lifting less than that, it's yeah, I don't think we would have seen near the gains. And there's also something to the fact that they were being watched for 8 weeks. You tend to push yourself a lot more if you've got researchers watching you perform every rep, every set.
If you've got anyone watching you, you're going to push yourself a little bit harder. Yeah, that's the training buddy effect.
Hmm. Yeah, and you don't have the choice of not showing up. I mean, they didn't miss workouts. If they missed, I think it was more than 15% of the scheduled workouts, we withdrew them from the study.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
So we had adherence. We had really high levels of macro tracking. It was designed, if you're going to gain muscle, this was the environment where it would happen.
Mm. I like that. I wonder how much, not you know, saying, all right, you're not dieting from the start, you're saying that, but you are tracking macros really tightly from the start. How much does that factor in? Just that awareness of macros, maybe for somebody who doesn't have that awareness.
Well, it's a lifestyle change for sure, because you're conscious of everything at that point. There's no sneaking M&Ms. Well, that doesn't matter. No, that needs to be tracked. Mm-hmm. Even though it wasn't a dieting study, the group that had the low protein intake, they, in essence, were dieting, because what we realized was they just cut their protein and they didn't do any compensation by increasing carbs and fat. Mm. So interestingly, we didn't want them to diet other than to hit their protein, which they did, but they reduced their calories, the low protein group.
Sure.
And in contrast, the high protein group did increase their calories because they had to increase their protein.
Mm. Okay, yeah. And the idea of having these macros in mind, regardless of what you're eating, is something that you've also studied in the framework of flexible dieting. Tell us about what you've been doing there.
Yeah, so to the best of my knowledge, we did the first study in resistance trained individuals with this flexible dieting paradigm.
So if it fits your macros, as people are
exactly
if it fits your
yes.
macros, yes.
So my graduate student at the time, Lauren Conlon, designed this study. She was in my lab. And what we did was we had two groups of people, males and females. They were all resistance trained. And we randomly assigned half of them to a macros, if it fits your macros group. We randomly assigned the other half to a meal plan group, or what we called the rigid dieting group. So they were given, here's what your breakfast should be, with a few exchanges, eggs maybe, or bacon, or you know, just different options for foods, but it was a fairly limited meal plan option list. So rigid foods, essentially. And the macro group, we said, or the if it fits your macros group, eat whatever you want, just make sure you hit your macros. Mm-hmm. And we encouraged them to get a variety of foods, but we didn't track that. Both groups reduced their calories by 25%, and they did that over a 10-week period. So it was a 10-week diet. The other nice thing that we did was, after the 10-week diet, we had a post-diet phase. And what we told him was, after the diet's over, for 10 weeks, don't diet anymore. Just do whatever you want. If you want to track, track. If you don't, we wanted to see how people would come out of these diets. How would their bodies respond if you were previously tracking or if you were following a rigid diet? So basically, there wasn't any significant differences in weight loss. Both groups lost about 5 pounds over the 10-week period. And remember, they were resistance training. The rigid dieting group, again, not significantly different, but lost a little more fat over the dieting period. Not significantly so, but it was more fat loss. The really intriguing part came during this post-diet phase. So after the 10 weeks of not doing anything, the group that was previously in the flexible dieting group actually gained a significant amount of lean body mass as compared to the rigid group.
So to repeat that, the rigid group lost a little bit more body fat, you say?
During the diet phase.
Yep.
But then the flexible dieters gained a little bit more lean body mass after the dieting phase.
So comparing body composition, you think were they primed for more long-term success then?
That's our takeaway.
Okay.
Now, I'd like to be able to tell you, well, here's why they gained more muscle mass over the 10-week post-diet phase. But I don't have an answer because we looked at calories, they were the same. Protein intake was the same. Mm-hmm. The amount of time that they spent in the weight room and doing cardio was the same.
Mm.
So you'd like to point to one of them and say, oh, they did this and that's why. It bothers me as a scientist not to have a reason.
Hmm.
Critics of flexible dieting and if it fits your macros always say, oh, that's just the lazy way to do it. You're not like, you know, they they think you're not being strict. And really what it sounds like is it's almost like you're creating a lifestyle mentality of, you know, okay, I know what my macros are, and as long as the food fits in what my macros are. And so to the critics, it's almost saying, here's some data showing that there might be more long-term benefits. We don't know why, but in kind of
and at least from our study, which is the only study we can draw from at this point. And I would say my own philosophy is I'd like flexible dieting, but it's not for everybody. Some people do much better with, tell me what to eat, give me a plan. And then that's what they should do.
Right. And it can also, depending on how it plays out in somebody's macros, not really be a health diet necessarily. Like, there's nothing in there telling you eat your vegetables.
No.
It's
no.
macros.
It is. Now, if you are taking this, let's say you're trying to get stage ready, the flexible food choices really start to get restricted on a flexible diet because there's not really room for cake when you're in a, when you're cutting a lot of calories.
Right.
You can still plan to have a little piece of cake, even getting ready for contest. But yes, it is flexible, but as calories keep getting cut and cut and cut, that flexibility isn't quite as flexible as what it is if you're not dieting.
It's almost like it self-selects, to the point where you become just like a rigid diet competitor when you're going into competition.
In both
of these things that we've talked about, I feel like part of what I'm hearing is don't let the scale tell the whole story.
Right.
Yes.
Even when the goal is fat loss or anything like that. And also, gains in muscle mass are a win.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yes. So how help someone who is saying, okay, you did these studies. I could do this, but I might not actually see the scale change at all. How is that a win for them?
So, again, I'm biased because I'm a scientist. I would say get more data than the scale. Mm-hmm. The scale may not change at all, and your physique may be drastically improving. Because if you're gaining muscle and losing fat, your body's changing.
For the better.
Mm-hmm. For the better. And almost always that's going to show out in how your clothes fit. Mm-hmm. But I have people that I work with just take a simple tape measurement of your waist. Let's do that in addition to the scale. The best thing to do would be to get somebody that you trust that's good with skinfold calipers and do an actual body composition assessment. Or if you go to a facility where they can use ultrasound or DEXA or BODPOD.
What do you think about the...
The handheld BIA.
We have one down in the basement here that's up from the feet. And then you have out to the side the electroimpedance, right?
Yeah,
if that's all somebody has access to,
that's great.
Should they stick with that consistently?
Absolutely. You're one step ahead of me. Whatever you use, even if it's not ideal, as long as you use the same thing over and over, as long as it's consistent in its readings, you're going to be able to detect changes. So anything is better than nothing. So the scale plus measuring your waist. Maybe a skinfold caliper, maybe those are called like handheld BIA devices. Now, again, I have the luxury of in my lab having high level ultrasound high level body water assessment machines. So I get to cheat a little bit. I've got really good stuff, but just with people that I work with, something more than the scale, because the scale could lead you to a false conclusion of what's happening.
Sure,
multiple points of data.
Both making you think that you have progress when it's actually negative progress.
Right.
But also, making you think there's no progress when there might be actually some really important and healthy body composition changes.
Yes.
So this was the first study, to your knowledge, of flexible dieting. Where's it going now? Because it sounds too good to be true for a lot of people. There must be things that still need to be studied next.
Yeah, so it was the first study in like a lean population. And it's funny, we do dieting studies. We're about to do a diet refeed study right now. We're going to start that in January, where we increase carbs 2 days per week. And when you look at the scientific literature, like 99% of all the studies on weight loss are in, not surprisingly, overweight or obese people. So when I talk to other scientists, they look at me like I'm crazy. Like, why are you studying weight loss in people who are already thin? And my answer is, well, there's a certain segment of the population that wants to go from good to great. And that's kind of what we're focusing on. So your question was, where are we going
What needs to be studied next about flexible dieting?
Well, one thing, like I said, adherence is key. So I'm not sending a message that flexible dieting is the best thing. I don't think that's true. It is great for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. I would say, though, on that note, I think everybody would benefit from doing flexible dieting and tracking your macros for like a 3, maybe a 6 months period of their life. You learn so much about food choices, mm-hmm. about overeating, undereating, when you're hungry. I think that would benefit.
Just the consciousness that comes.
Yes,
with it.
Mm-hmm. It is. Because I've taken some people who had, you know, no concept of flexible dieting and said, let's go through the education of this. They will never, for the rest of their lives, they will change, at least consciously. They might not change their behavior, but they'll know, oh, that donut is a lot different than that chicken sandwich. Mm-hmm. Even though the calories may be the same.
The matrix right. mindset. All of a sudden, it just spreads
yes.
apart.
Yes. Calories, it's almost like calories alone is just one data point because you're not really taking into account what those calories are made of.
Yes.
So, you know, you're just yes. adding numbers together, but you're not thinking about what's going into it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
So, okay, very cool.
Okay. So, but is adherence the great strength of this, aside from that consciousness of food?
Yeah, I think for most people, a flexible diet is... It encourages adherence. So let's say one day you just blew it. You're driving by, I don't know, Chick-fil-A, and instead of getting my one chicken sandwich, I got 3 and a milkshake and French fries. Okay, a lot of people, especially if they're following a plan, well, I'll start next week. I just blew it this week. Whereas a flexible dieting approach would say, okay, yeah, you overate today, but tomorrow we're going to lower our macros and we'll compensate for what you did today. Mm-hmm. So it's almost self-correcting.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So not just thinking in terms of the day. You can think in terms of
the week.
Several days or the week.
Yeah. So when I work with individual clients, we track the day. Mm-hmm. But one of my primary markers is at the end of the week, where are you at with your average carbs, protein, and fat intake? Mm. And then it's really cool because you can start to see, okay, I see on these 2 days you were really high. Well, now maybe we should plan to increase your calories on days like the weekend a little bit more, and we can reduce your calories on the other days where you don't struggle as much, kind of like a diet refeed mm-hmm. approach. Mm-hmm. So you asked what's next. I like all these other popular dieting paradigms out there. So flexible dieting, we looked at that. The next thing is diet refeeds. Mm-hmm. So what we're looking at there is we're going to have resistance trained people work out in my lab. My graduate student, Danielle Aguilar, is coordinating that study. And we're going to have one group have the same 25% calorie reduction every day of the week. The other group is going to have 2 days of pretty high carbohydrates for 2 days out of the week. And then the other 5 days, their calories are a little bit lower than the other group. But both groups are going to be cut by 25%. Mm-hmm. And what we're looking at is, does the diet refeed, does it have a benefit over an 8-week diet? And we're going to look at resting metabolic rate, leptin, body composition.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And seeing if maybe kind of like that protein, it sounded like it ended up being almost free calories. Mm-hmm. Maybe this refeed could end up being free?
Well, we won't be able to say that because everybody's going to have the same 25% reduction. Mm-hmm. But there are going to be 2 days where they get more carbs, but they're kind of paying for that on the other 5 days because they get lower calories on the other days.
Just out of curiosity, and I'm sure you're doing this, are you doing questionnaires with these individuals? Are you assessing kind of how they're feeling when they're on these diets? Because that's what a lot of people, when they choose flexible dieting or rigid dieting, that seems to be kind of the overriding factor is I just feel better or
yes.
I'm not as cranky with my family.
Yeah, so no, and you make me appreciate the fact I should be doing that.
But I'm sure you're doing this.
No, I was trained as a physiologist, so I'm very focused on fat, mm-hmm. muscle, performance.
You want
and
data.
Yes, and that is good
data. Are people
data.
Crying in the lab often about it? Only when they're doing the cycle sprints, maybe.
The reason I bring it up is every single competition that you go to, you know, the guy's on stage, he's got the trophy in his hand, and he thanks his lovely wife and kids for putting up with how cranky he's been for the past 8 weeks. And so a lot of these new competitors are talking about, yeah, this past competition was easy because I was flexible dieting, or this past competition was easy because I was doing this diet. And so that would be, I'm curious about that, if you could study that in a lab setting.
Yeah, we need to do more psychological measures. I don't want to get into a rabbit trail here, but we tried to do that in our diet refeed study. We were going to do a POMS, a profile of mood states, mm-hmm. but the university IRB, the board that approves the study, had issues with that questionnaire that I wasn't prepared to address. Mm-hmm. So we planned, and I would say we got shot down. But for you, in the next one, we will incorporate a psychological question.
We're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you one other question about flexible dieting also. Similar to the protein study, I want you to compare flexible dieting with lifting regularly to flexible dieting without that component for somebody who's, if you're just looking at YouTube, Instagram, the flexible dieting crew is often a regular training population.
Yes.
But for somebody who just looks at it from the outside, maybe they're not strength training regularly, how much of a difference does that make in success with these sorts of things?
Well, I think the first question I would have, what is their goal? Mm-hmm. If their goal is to lose weight, they're flexible dieting, as long as you reduce your calories, it's going to work great. Now, are you going to change your body shape without resistance training? No. Mm-hmm. Resistance training is, I always like to explain it like this. If you are just trying to go from overweight to good, that's 90, 95% diet. You're not going to exercise your way to a great physique. But if you're already lean and you're trying to go from a good physique to a great physique, that is where your resistance training program now starts to take on a much larger role mm-hmm. in that journey.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And you did another article for us about the keys to long-term weight loss.
Yes.
And I believe one of them was lifting also.
So that's principle number three.
Right. Exactly. If you're thinking just in terms of, all right, I'm trying to get from this number to this number and that's the end goal. Okay. Yeah. Maybe that's pure diet. But if you're looking out further for how can I actually change my life, is strength training essential to that?
Yes. Because that's what will maintain your muscle mass during a diet. Mm-hmm. And it will also help prevent your metabolism from being suppressed as much. Mm-hmm. So it's got a huge metabolic advantage during a diet, and it will actually change your physique. Without resistance training, you lose weight, so you're just a smaller, puffier version of yourself. But resistance training actually changes your physique, your contours.
It's pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah, I'm very biased on resistance training, if you haven't noticed.
Well, Dr. Bill Campbell, thanks for coming and talking with us. How do people find out more about what you're up to if they want to learn about you and about this laboratory?
Yeah, so my Instagram is Bill Campbell, PhD. So I'd love to have followers. They can see what I'm up to on that. And if they're interested in coming to graduate school to be involved in these types of research studies, I'm at the University of South Florida, and my email is bcampbell@usf.edu.
Wonderful. Well, thank you for coming by.
Thank you.